for this talk, which is long as it is, I'm just going to leave the equality constraints. The inequality constraints are more complicated and harder to deal with, but they can be dealt with in a similar type way to what I'm going to show you here, although it's a non-trivial extension. Okay. So again, optimization, like PDEs, have its own religions within. And now some of the things that people, of course, argue all the time about. What do you want to do, continuous or discrete optimization? So what do I mean continuous? Well, remember that before we had a PDE. PDE lives in a continuous space. So you can say, well, I want to do the optimization in Hilbert space. I don't want to do the optimization in a discrete space. So some people like to do the optimization in continuous space. Think about continuous problems and doing the optimization in the continuous space. Some other people like to do the optimization in the discrete space. This leads to something which is called discretize and optimize versus optimize and discretize. Okay? What I'm going to be talking about is discretize first, then optimize. Otherwise, we would not have been talking about discretizing the PDEs that I was just spending all this time on. So I'm assuming first I'm discretizing the problem I have. I have a problem with parameters that are continuous. I'm discretizing that thing first. Then I'm trying to do the optimization. That's the route I'm going to take. It's not the only route. It's not necessarily... for some problems, you may want to do it differently. I like particularly this route, and I'm going to explain to you why I like this as we go along. It's actually, I think, important. Okay, global versus local. Okay, so global means that there are many, many, many minimums, and you're trying to find the minimum. And local means that you start somewhere, and you're converging to the minimum which is closest to you in some way. Now, global is a much harder problem, which I'm not going to discuss. I'm going to discuss the local problems. Now, people that are in this business sometimes talk to people that are interested in global and actually ask them why do they want to get a global. And there are discussions about these kind of things. But again, I'm not going to get into this. A bit more loaded question is stochastic versus deterministic. So that actually relates in some way to the problem above. So there are lots of people who are interested in genetic algorithms and simulating annealing and all these other things that I am not. Okay, and this talk is not going to discuss these kind of algorithm. I'm going to discuss deterministic type algorithm that gets you to the local minima. Okay, and of course, constrained and unconstrained, and the question which one to work. Maybe yesterday we kind of got a hint of that when people in the KKT type world says, well, the question was to eliminate or not to eliminate. So do you want to stay with the constraints or not to stay with the constraint? And some people think that it's better to stay with the constraint, some people not. I'm going to actually talk about this in a bit more length. Okay, books. Personally, I love this book, Nossa Dylan Wright. Fletcher is I like personally. And there are some others. Classical, there are way more, of course. Okay, so let's kind of shortly go about how we do unconstrained optimization. Well, we have to, now I'm thinking about a discrete problem again, so we have a variable m, which is a vector variable because it's discretized somehow, and we want to minimize a function here where m is just a bunch of numbers here, so it's a vector. Okay, and we're looking for a local minimizer here in this case. Well, the necessary condition for this thing is the gradient is zero. That's you all know. And second order conditions, which we almost never check in practice, is that the Hessian is going to be, in this case, positive semi-definite. Okay, so it's something to remember because most of the, if you think about a large scale problem, which most of us here, I guess, do, well, most of us do not really calculate the eigenvalues of whatever we get at the end of the day, but we kind of think that they're going to be okay. And it's something that we will kind of address in some way or another later on. Okay, so how do you design a numerical algorithm for numerical optimization? In general, most of the algorithms that you would see, or all the algorithms I'll talk about here, are iterative in nature. So you start from a certain point, which is m0 here, and you're going to generate a sequence of points in space. And what you're going to make the next point, the function there is going to be smaller, but not just smaller. Smaller apparently is not enough. It has to be sufficiently smaller, and there are proofs for what is sufficient. And to do that, of course, what I need to do is to generate a direction. So I'm going to generate a direction, and I'm going to take a step size, and I'm going to update my, I'm going to get my new model by taking the old one plus alpha p. Okay, so when I write it like that, it's not always like that. I decouple the problem into two problems, really. Finding a direction, okay, and finding a step size. That's all I need to do, in a sense. Okay, so how can you actually do these kind of things? Well, let's assume we have first a direction. So let's assume we picked a direction somehow. Then a line search can be applied to the order to find alpha. So the thing is this. First, I need to find to make sure that my direction is a descent direction, so that it's taking me down. So you can think about standing up on a hill. Obviously, that every direction that takes you up is not going to be a good one. So there has to be some condition that this direction goes down. This is the condition that the transpose times the gradient is smaller than zero. This is the condition that makes sure that my direction is a descent direction. If this does not happen, you're in trouble. Okay? It will come actually important. So you may think that this is a trivial thing to check, by the way, but it may not be that trivial, because sometimes to just get the direction P, for example, or to get the gradient will require a lot of work. Okay? So if you have, for example, only an approximate way to get the gradient, it's not necessarily clear that it's so easy to check this condition. But let's say that this condition does hold, then what you can do in order to get alpha is to solve this one-dimensional problem to minimize alpha. Now, in the early days, people actually done this problem exactly. So they actually minimized along this alpha exactly, but then they actually proved that you don't have to do this exactly. Surprisingly enough, it's actually even better to do it inexactly. So you can actually show that for some problems, you converge faster if you do this minimization over this alpha inexactly rather than doing it exactly. Okay? Now, this is a very trivial thing up to here, but there is something that I want to stop over here and talk about, which is a guideline, at least for many, many problems in applied or computational mathematics. So if you think about it, you have to minimize over alpha here, and you can do this to generate your new model. Okay? And the question is, should you do it really? I mean, should you actually do the minimization? And the reason why you don't want to do it is that if you do the minimization exactly, what are you going to do next? Well, you're going to immediately change the problem, because now you're going to generate a new descent direction, and now you have to do it again. So in some way, if we're going to change the problem every time, like every iteration, then solving every problem exactly kind of looks redundant. I mean, you're investing all this work to solve a problem exactly, which is not even an important problem, because you're changing it in the minute that you solve it. So it's actually some kind of a key line of thought in optimization, because you will see again, I'm going to talk about, for example, truncated Newton method, which kind of comes in the same way. You don't want to solve the system of equations too well, because in a second you're going to solve a new system of equations. So why worry about and solve it that well? And this is something that you kind of have to put it as a line of, or something that you need to think about as a principle, that when you have a problem that you're changing every second, you want to try to avoid of solving the exact solution of the problem that you're going to switch in a second exactly. Okay? So this is definitely one of the things that people have done here for this very simple problem. Okay? So this is a line search idea. There is a trust region method, for those of you who know something about it. I'm not going to cover this in any kind of length. Is that what you do is you replace, so you're coupling, so here we have a direction and we have a step length. What you can do is you can couple them together. You can couple the direction and the step length together and to find P, which is both, give you the direction and the step length. And what you do is you change the function. Remember, you have F here. So we change the function to a quadratic approximation over here. Okay? And we want the direction to be smaller than something. Okay? By the way, this is a constraint optimization problem, obviously, but it's actually a simple constraint optimization. And you can actually solve this problem relatively simply and get a direction like this. Okay, so you're coupling it all together. The linear system that comes here are actually becoming more complicated than the one here, and it adds complexity to coding. If you ever coded a trust region method, you will find out that it's much more involved. It's supposed to be more robust, but it's more involved than just coding this one, which is just a line search, which is extremely easy to code, by the way. So here are a few descent directions that are very common. First one, steepest descent. You think about it again, you're on a hill, you want to go to the steepest descent, and that's just equal to minus the gradient. Okay, so that's the first one. The second one, which is a very nice method, although it's very old, is the Newton's method. And it doesn't matter how old it is and how many sophisticated algorithms you're going through, every time this is the golden standard in some way. If you can do a Newton method, if you really can do this, it's a very nice thing. I'm going to say something about it in a second. The other thing is you can say, well, if this is a if grad f is a minus grad f is a descent direction, then if I replace this guy by B inverse, which is going to be positive definite matrix, it's for sure going to give me a descent direction. Okay, so it's a descent direction. That's kind of fine. Okay, that's giving me something. Now, how do I choose this wisely? That's a different question, which I'm going to address in the next few transparencies. Now, what are the differences? I mean, why to use one versus another? Well, obviously, you can imagine immediately that steepest descent is the easiest thing to do. Okay, you calculated the gradient. Now, just go in the direction of the gradient. So why not do this? Well, it converges very slow. I mean, converges linearly. But, you know, so linearly, by the way, I actually hate the linear convergence in the sense that it's really undefined. So let me just say something about it. So linearly, in the sense, if every iteration linearly converges, but with the constant point one, that's great. You know, I would never ask for something more, because if you have an error which is one and then point one and point 0.001 and so on, it's great. But linearly can also be 0.99. Okay, and that's maybe the problem. So when people say linearly, it's almost like saying nothing in some way, because you don't really know how bad or how good linearly is. Multigrid, for example, which we all liked and just talked before, also converges linearly. But linear good, in a sense, in many ways. So linearly kind of says nothing, but steepest descent is bad linearly, usually. Converge relatively slow. Newton, on the other hand, converges quadratically. Okay, and quadratically is hard to beat, because even if you take quadratic with a very bad constant, quadratically, you'll find out that in a very few iterations, you actually converge to the correct solution. So this is why Newton is, in some way, the golden standard. If you can do a quadratic convergence, it's hard to beat. The only problem is that for this quadratic convergence, you are paying, as usual. So you're paying in what? In inverting this matrix. Okay. So a lot of effort, of course, have to be invested in inverting this matrix. And there is one more issue I'm going to talk about in a second. So you can now say, quasi-Newton, I'm kind of in the middle somewhere. Okay, I'm using this BK inverse. And in some way, I may need to invert this, but hopefully this is simpler than that. The other thing about it is that we just said something about the conditions for convergence, that the Hessian has to be positive definite. But what happens if it's not, because you're far from the solution? This is becoming an indefinite system. Inverting indefinite systems can be a problem. Also, can be worse than that. You can maybe even, so somebody will, if you're just linear algebra and all you care about inverting this system, you will invert the system at the end of the day, but it will give you the wrong direction. It will take you uphill versus downhill. This is even worse. So actually, inverting this system is the wrong thing to do. You don't even want to invert the system. So this B is supposed to replace this guy when you're not even sure that it is positive definite. This is the three main type of algorithms. I'm going to say something about them a bit more later on, or some of them, but you have to remember that there are trade-offs to use one versus the other. Usually, if you can use a Newton when you're close by, you're doing very well, but not always. You cannot always do this just because of the cost. Steepest descent is a method that I rarely recommend to use, and this one is usually try to combine both of two worlds. Okay. What happens when you have a large-scale problem, okay, which is what we're interested in a sense? So here, h is going to be the second derivative over there. And we need to solve this Newton system that we just talked about. Well, the nice thing that you can do is you can actually solve it by conjugate gradient method. Okay. Now, there is a lot of literature on that. The question is, do you need to solve it exactly or inexactly? And as I said before, if you are going to switch the problem in a second, so you're solving this, but next thing you're going to do is to get a new iteration and change the matrix, you may not want to do this exactly. This leads to inexact Newton methods when they say you have to truncate the iteration. You don't have to, but you if you want to save on cost, you can truncate the iteration early in order to save some of your computational cost. And when to truncate is a series of papers and depends on what kind of convergence you want, linear or quadratic or superlinear, and that's a topic for itself. The other interesting thing about this method, and one of the reasons I personally particularly like it, is that what happened in the case that the Hessian does not have all positive eigenvalues, that it have positive and negative eigenvalues. In principle, you would think you should not use the Hessian, you should use something else. But there is an algorithm, which is called Seinhold-CG, which allows you to stop the iteration early when you identify conjugate gradients, allows you to identify negative curvature, so eigenvalues that are going in the wrong direction. And in that case, you can stop when you actually identify an eigenvalue which is going in the wrong direction. And it's a very powerful method to terminate the iteration and to know something about the eigenvalues of your matrix without actually computing anything real, but doing through the iteration. So that's why it's a very, very powerful method. You'll find many, many books and papers that describe it. And it's one of the most recommended methods in many ways if you can actually calculate your Hessian. Okay. So again, and that leads immediately to iterative type methods. So just again, to recap the difference maybe between just doing linear algebra and linear algebra in the context of optimization, is that now when you're doing the linear algebra, like a conjugate gradient solver, you really have to think about what matrix are you solving. Is it really positive, definite, or maybe not? And if it's not, it doesn't mean you have to solve it, but what can you do? What kind of tricks you can use with the linear algebra that you do know in order to get only the positive part of it, for example? So these are, again, the differences that you have to think about one level up, in a sense, of thinking how you can use the linear algebra tricks that you do know to do the optimization in this case. Okay? So again, these are termination criteria, and again, there is lots of literature on these kind of conditions, and what conditions do you really need in order to make it work, or to make it work fast. Now, just to kind of look at these conditions for a second, so you have that the residual here is going to be smaller than eta times the gradient, which is the right-hand side over there, correct? So this is of the linear system, where eta k is smaller than some eta, which is smaller than 1, okay? So basically, you have to improve or where you are right now. That's what it says. Now, the interesting thing about it, that if you still want to maintain the quadratic convergence, you have to drive this eta k to 0. So every iteration, you need to tighten the tap on your solver. It has to be more and more. You have to solve better and better. And you can think about this in the sense that it's, again, going to cost you, because now you... Every iteration maybe takes more conjugate gradient iteration to solve that system over here. So it costs you more. If you are willing to stay with a constant eta, so Tim Kelly has his famous number, 0.1, as he called the Tim Kelly constant, you can stop with 0.1, then you're going to stuck with linear convergence. It's not necessarily bad again. It could be linear good in a sense, but you're with linear convergence. So it may take more steps. So it's the usual type of argument, what do you want to do? More steps here or more steps there, and which one is going to be better? Unfortunately, there is no answer that you can just throw and say, okay, this is what you should do always. Okay, now, another thing which is very, very useful for large-scale problems, which I particularly very like, are quasi-Newton methods. Okay, there is, again, huge amount of literature on quasi-Newton methods, and you're going to replace this HK by a matrix BK. Now, usually, this matrix have a certain form, okay? And the form is that you take UI times UI transpose, so that's going to be, actually, there is a mistake here. I now notice it. There is plus H0. I forgot H0 here, which is very important, actually. Without H0, it's not even invertible if I have only L terms. So you replace it by some matrix that you know. So, for example, H0 would be the identity, plus some perturbations like this, which basically a rank one perturbations. Now, the nice thing about this kind of thing, and people have invested a lot of effort, is to show that you can invert this H by basically doing a recursive type algorithm. So you don't really need to calculate an inverse of a matrix, which is the hard point of the inverse of a matrix time a vector. So no conjugate gradient, no any kind of very fancy stuff. All you have to do is to do a recursion. You just know these vectors. You know what U0 is, and you can just go forward and do it. Now, I need to write something, and that's actually important. I forgot to write there. Where is this? Because people always say it, and I don't like when they say, I said it right now, which is wrong. People always say it. So I should write the approximation. And as I goes from 1 to L. And as I said before, what you can do is you can calculate this kind of stuff recursively, the inverse of this kind of stuff recursively, but the point is that you still need to invert, you still need to calculate at least H inverse V somehow. So that implies that if this is equal to W, I can solve H0W is equal to V. So for large-scale problems, you're not going to factor H or H0 or anything like that. You're just going to use an iterative method to invert it. And therefore, the use of iterative method, even though you have a quasi-Newton method, is still useful because you still have to do this kind of trick over here when you're trying to invert to solve this kind of system. Okay? Now, for simple problems, you can choose H0 to be identity. You don't have to do this. For a very complicated or more complicated problem, you have to do a wise choice of this H, and it's not going to be an identity for most serious problems. Okay? Then you really have to have a solver here, and it really has to be, you still have to use the skills that you have, the linear algebra skills that you have, and it's a crucial point. People, many cases, miss it. They say, no, you can just choose identity. And in many cases, identity just does not work. There are some conditions that make it work.
Okay. What's the significance of those UI terms?
That's the next thing I'm going to say, not exactly where they come from. So, but in some way related. So HK is a matrix, and it's a matrix that have n times n numbers in it. In principle, we didn't talk about sparsity or anything like that. Now you replace this n by n matrix by another matrix. Obviously, if you have n times n matrix, n times n numbers, there is no way in the world you're going to find a unique way to just put them together. That implies immediately that you can have a bunch of methods to do the same thing, which allows for many people to write many papers. So the question where the U comes from, that now depends on the way that you decide to solve this thing. Now, the way to look at it is this way. Maybe if you ask, I'll answer. Not yet. No. So if you look at what we're trying to solve H times P is equal to the minus gradient of F, okay? So if I did this, if I now have 2 points here, if I have a gradient, so let's say that I have 2 points. So I have gradient of FK, and I have FK minus one. So if I look at this thing, okay, so I'm looking at these two differences here. By Taylor expansion, that's by Taylor expansion, right? So this is something that I do have in my hand, correct? I calculated the gradient of F. I calculated before the gradient of FK minus 1. P is something I have in my hand as well because I already took the update. So now I have one equation, correct? But one equation, so it's n equation. So one vector equation. So this is n equations for which the matrix H appears in. The only problem here again is H is n by n numbers. So it's n by n numbers, but only n equations. That again allows many people to write many papers. But again, I would say that the most successful one, at least my experience, and if somebody else would have different ones, but I'm just telling you my personal experience, is that the LBFGS, I personally like it very much. It's a method that allows you to, again, store these kind of vectors and allows you to solve these kind of things without actually inverting any matrix besides the H0 matrix, okay? And it also allows you to store only a limited number of these vectors. That's an important issue. Because obviously, if you're doing a long optimization process, you cannot store 500 vectors if the problem is large. But these are one of the most successful methods to actually solve large-scale problems. I mean, if they're tuned right and you do the right choice of things. Okay. So with that, you know, what was it? 20 minutes. We've covered unconstrained optimization. I'm going to move quickly to constrained optimization. So now we have minimized function, but now if you notice, I have a U over there. Before I didn't have one. And subject to M and U, C of M and U is equal to zero. C is going to be the PDE in this case. So now U is going to be the U that we had before, and M is going to be the model. And now we're thinking about the PDE that connects between them. Okay. So how do you solve these kind of things? In principle, if you look at the Lagrangian of this thing, then the solution is supposed to be a stationary point of a Lagrangian. Okay. Now, this is just a way to demonstrate this thing. So think about this as C. This is basically what we had before. Think about this as C of M and U. This is a constraint. So this is your constraint, okay? Connection between M and U. So this is M, this is U. This is what you want to minimize. And now when we look at this thing, we think that the solution lies over here, okay? So this is the view of the constraint versus unconstrained view. In the constrained approach, we're allowed to be off the constraint. We don't have to live on this tweaked line. In the unconstrained world, we basically eliminate constraint and we have to live on this line. Okay, so now we have an extra degree of freedom because we can live anywhere in this space. We hope we go to the same point at the end. Okay, that's an important issue. Okay, so what do we have to assume about the constraint to make this thing work? Well, if we look at the matrix B, just to confuse you with the previous matrix B, but I'm using the matrix B because everybody yesterday actually used the matrix B for the constraint, and this, which is actually the derivatives of the PDE with respect to M and U, okay, then this matrix is supposed to have a full column. Okay? And the necessary condition, as we said before, is differentiating the Lagrangian with respect to M, U, and lambda, and equating to zero. That's a necessary condition, which is written over here. Okay, this is what happens when you differentiate the Lagrangian. Okay. Now, I just want to kind of state again the point with the relation to PDEs and optimization. Just remember that C was a PDE. So this is a derivative of the PDE with respect to the model parameters. This is with respect to the field. Okay, and you need to know how to do these kind of things. Read, for example, the comment on meshing. If your PDE involves a meshing algorithm before, you need to put it in here somehow. It's not really clear to me how you do it in this case. There are some examples of processes that you do in order to simulate that if your PDE involves doing a process of things, it's not really clear how you differentiate them. So this is where the problems can arise when you're using a PDE package which you don't really control. You don't have any control really on. Okay, well, how do you solve these kind of problems? The first simple way is to do constraint elimination. Okay, so if we have a constraint, C of M of U is equal to zero, I can just, in some miraculous way, eliminate the constraint, which we'll show a few examples later on. And now I have an unconstrained problem. Let's go back and solve what we already know. Of course, the difficulty may be that this elimination of the constraint, this G operator, may be something very involved. In the best case, it can be inverting a matrix. In the worst case, it could be a nonlinear iteration by itself. So this may be expensive. Okay. Another approach, because people like unconstrained optimization in a sense, is to use a penalty. So people say, okay, let's put this function here, and let's add a constraint either square or just with the absolute value. And when we do that, then we can just solve it. Again, unconstrained optimization problem. We have to solve a sequence of unconstrained optimization problems because we have a parameter mu here, and this parameter have to be driven to zero. So you can see that numerically something here is not going to be very nice. And if you listen to what Chen had to say yesterday, even for the whole KKT system, this first block was exactly the derivative of this kind of problem. And as mu goes to zero, this thing becomes very ill-conditioned, and you may have problems to solve the unconstrained optimization problem. So this is, people don't really like it in many ways. Then one way is to avoid these kind of things is to use an augmented Lagrangian, which I'm not, okay, there are books about this thing. So I'm not going to cover this whole thing in any length whatsoever. But the idea is that you're basically trying to have your term, which is a penalty term, but you're adding also the term from the Lagrangian. So by the way, it depends on which direction you come to this augmented Lagrangian. Some people, actually myself included usually, like to think about it as the Lagrangian plus the augmented part. If you're a penalty person, you think about the penalty, but then you added the Lagrangian part. So, but that depends on also the way that you write your package. Now, the nice thing about this kind of approach is that when you differentiate things, it generates you get at the end of the day this KKT matrix, and the block A turns out to be a symmetric positive definite at the end of the day. Choosing the parameter mu is not necessarily simple, although there are a bunch of algorithms to do it. Okay. However, what I like personally, what I'm going to talk about, is something which is called sequential quadratic programming, SQP. And it's actually a very simple and direct direct continuation to any kind of optimization approach. So what you do is, if you think about it, you take your function and you expand it around M and U. Okay. So now you have two directions, PM and PU. So one of them corresponds to M and one to U. And the first term there, the top there, is just a straightforward Taylor expansion, second order Taylor expansion, of the function. Okay. So you have the function, you have the gradient times PM and U, and you have half. And this is a quadratic term where WK is going to be, well, either an approximate to the second order function or to, well, some approximation of it. So that's something you can easily do. The only problem is, and then you have a constraint. Okay, you linearize the constraint again. The only problem, and this is something that I will discuss through this thing again, is how are you actually going to judge that you're doing a good way? You remember before we talked about unconstrained optimization, it was clear that, okay, you have a point. The next point is supposed to have a smaller function value, right? This time it's actually completely not clear that this is what you want to have. I will actually go up to here. So think about this point. You're here and you're going to here. Is this a good or a bad iterate? Well, obviously, or maybe not obviously, you're further from the constraint than you are here. I mean, it actually is obvious. I mean, here you basically satisfy the constraint and here you're not, correct? So you went far away from the constraint. On the other hand, obviously, if you know the solution, you went closer to the solution. So you decreased the objective function, but you went further from the constraint. You can find examples that this does work and the other one does not work. So it's not really clear what you want to do. Do you want to get closer to the constraint? You want to stay on the constraint? You want to get closer to the solution of the, closer to the objective, the minimum of the objective? It's not that clear. Okay, you can think just about taking this one and putting it exactly in the zero over there. Well, you went all the way to the zero of the objective function, but you're very far from the constraint. You probably did a bad iterate. So it's not that clear what is the right direction you should take. That makes it actually, this is what makes these kind of methods very hard to deal with. Now, one way to deal with these kind of things is to use a merit function. That's the way it's called. And what it does, it takes the function plus the constraints and weight them somehow with a parameter mu. And how to choose this parameter mu is a lengthy type of bunch of literature. In this case of this function, which is just the one norm of the constraints, is actually a relatively simple one. You have the two norm involves more, and then there is a bunch of other stuff which comes with this. It's actually not a simple thing. And this is when you're doing these, if you're interested in actually doing SQP, this is where most of your problems are going to come, unless you have a simple problem. Okay? If you have a simple problem, then no globalization, basically no problem of determining if the next iteration is better than this one is really required. But if it is, then this is where you're going to get stuck. You may be able to solve the linear system, but you're not going to know if you're going to take a good or a bad iterate. Recently, there is a method which is called the filter method, which Fletcher actually came up with, and it's working on a different idea. If anybody wants to talk about this later, I'm willing to learn. Okay, so what are the linear systems that we get out of this thing? Is our famous KKT system that we talked before yesterday. And in the SQP world, what you do is very simple, solve and update. Okay? You just saw yesterday that solve is not that simple. I'm going to talk about it later on. But you just solve and then you update. So what are the difficulties in this case? What could be the difficulties? Well, BK can be, of course, very large in our application. It relates to a PDE. So, I mean, you can think in many cases, you cannot even store. I mean, you're not going to even generate the matrix. You may be doing matrix vector products, but even storing this matrix is unheard of. Okay, think about the time domain problem that I had before. For all the times, you have a three-dimensional problem with all the times together. You're not going to form this stuff. Okay, but you have to think that this is something that can you can have over there. Okay. Now, also, in most of these kind of things, the meat of the matrix is going to be on the B because it's the PDE stuff. Okay, in most of these cases, the meat of the matrix is going to lay on the B and not on this W. Okay, the other problem that can be here, and I'm going to talk about it in the next part of this thing, is that the system itself can be very strongly coupled. So it doesn't necessarily mean that it is strongly coupled, and I'm going to talk about examples that it's not. And this is going to go back to where the PDE case. But if it is strongly coupled, then it's what I would call a real KKT system. And then it's actually becoming more complicated to solve it. Okay. W, of course, can be singular. So if you have algorithms that work with inverting this W, well, you can forget about them because it could be singular. And this is actually common for many, many applications. It's singular. Most design problems, actually, W can be singular. So this is something that you have to think about. And of course, this whole thing can be ill-conditioned because why can it be ill-conditioned? Well, B is a PDE. If my PDE is the grid is very fine, then just the PDE itself is ill-conditioned. The PDE is embedded into a bigger problem. Well, it's likely that if the conditioning is bad for the PDE, it's going to just make a whole problem ill-conditioned. The ill-conditioning can come from other resources, as we will see in the next part of this lecture, but the whole thing can be very ill-conditioned and therefore very hard to solve. So it's not easy to solve these things. And I'll be I'll say what I think about this in a sense. I don't think that right now we are in a position to write a general purpose package that can solve every KKT system. I think that KKT systems have very different types, depends where the meat is, depends where, you know, where the problems are, and you have to think about different ways, like Chen was presenting yesterday, for example. There are all these different avenues you should take, and that depends on what applications you have, where the meat of the matrix is, what you should do with this. And I'm going to go back to this in the next part of the talk. So with this, I would like to take now 10 minutes of, 10 minutes even less if you can, of coffee break, and then return to the last part of this thing.